Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and Susan Shand. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, the suspect in the series of deadly bombings in the American state of Texas killed himself in an explosion early Wednesday. Police ended the 3-week search for the suspect, but warned that there might be more unexploded bombs out there. An official told the Associated Press that the suspect was Mark Anthony Condit. He was 24 years old. Pflugerville Mayor Victor Gonzalez told the AP that Condit lived 2 blocks away from his house. The city is near the Texas capital of Austin. Officials are still looking for the reason behind the 5 bombings and whether the suspect acted alone. The 4 bombings in Austin and 1 in nearby San Antonio killed 2 people and wounded 4 others. Austin Police Chief Brian Manley said officers were watching the suspect in the last 24 to 36 hours. They found his vehicle at a hotel in Round Rock. As they prepared to move in for an arrest, the man drove away. Manley said officers were following the vehicle when it went off the road. The officers moved toward the car on foot. The suspect then exploded a bomb inside his vehicle. The force blew 1 officer back and killed the suspect. The Austin American Statesman newspaper reported that officials had identified the suspect based largely on a security video. The suspect had sent a bomb from a FedEx store in Austin. Officials believe he was responsible for all the bombings. However, they warned of the possibility of more bombs. Chief Manley said, "We don't know where this suspect has spent his last 24 hours, and therefore we still need to remain vigilant to ensure that no other packages or devices have been left to the community." Fred Milinowski is an agent with the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. He said it was hard to say if the bombing suspect had acted alone. He said, "What we do know is we believe the same person built each one of these devices."
This week, a self-driving vehicle struck and killed a woman in the American state of Arizona. The death is believed to be the first involving a fully autonomous car on U.S. public roads. The vehicle was operating in self-driving mode when it hit a 49-year-old woman crossing the street near the city of Phoenix. Police say Elaine Hertzberg was walking with her bicycle outside the road's crosswalk when she was struck. The Volvo SUV, belonging to the ride-sharing company Uber, was traveling at about 65 kilometers an hour. A driver was sitting in the vehicle's seat even though the car was set to drive itself. After the crash, Uber announced it was halting all its road testing programs while the incident is investigated. Local and federal officials are taking part in the investigation. Some transportation experts believe the deadly crash could slow the development of self-driving technology. They argue that U.S. lawmakers and the public may resist the technology if they believe self-driving cars will repeatedly make deadly mistakes. Nicholas Evans is a professor of philosophy at the University of Massachusetts in Lowell, Massachusetts. He thinks Uber made the right decision to stop its self-driving tests while the crash is investigated. But he says future accidents could change public opinion about the technology.
I think that consumers get very worried about kind of dramatic individual episodes, and that can really shake consumer confidence in products and investor confidence in products.
Evans said companies test self-driving vehicles in different ways.
At the moment, companies like Tesla and Uber are taking a more kind of open-ended approach to their testing. They're just kind of putting their cars out there and seeing what happens.
On the other hand, Evans said Waymo, Google's self-driving vehicle company, is carrying out its testing more scientifically, closer to the way medical trials are done. For example, Waymo is choosing areas in the country with different environmental conditions to test its vehicles. Right now, Evans is specifically studying ways to make driverless vehicles capable of making ethical decisions. In many situations, vehicles will have to quickly decide levels of risk. These risks could relate to the driver of the self-driving car, other drivers or passengers on the road, or pedestrians. For example, a self-driving vehicle might have to decide whether to save its own driver or crash to avoid a vehicle carrying numerous people, like a school bus. Evans is receiving money from the National Science Foundation to study the ethics of decision-making algorithms in autonomous vehicles. He says self-driving cars need to be programmed to react to many difficult situations. But, he adds, even simple driving activities, such as having vehicles enter a busy street, can be dangerous. One of the most basic questions is how to decide the value of human lives. Evans says most people do not like to think about this question. But, he says, it is highly important in developing self-driving technology. A driver might believe that since the vehicle belongs to him, the car should be programmed to take care of that person above all others. Or some might believe that pedestrians should always be protected in crash situations. Evans says whom to value is one of the most difficult parts of teaching a driverless car to act on its own.
So this is one of the really tricky questions behind autonomous vehicles is how do you value different people's lives and how do you program a car to value different people's lives?
As a philosophy professor, Evans teaches ethics to engineers working on self-driving cars and other technologies. He says one of his first assignments is to discuss an often heard argument by supporters of self-driving technology who want to keep moving quickly with development. They argue that up to 90% of current traffic accidents are caused by human error. This number, they argue, would be greatly reduced if machines take over the driving. But Evans says his students realize this argument alone does not permit them to move carelessly. They must still carry out thoughtful, safe testing of the technology. I'm Brian Lynn.
The problem of obesity worldwide affects three times as many people as it did in 1975. That fact comes from the World Health Organization. Obesity is no longer just a problem for the United States and other industrial nations. There is a growing number of overweight and obese people in other countries. Being overweight has been linked to more deaths around the world than being underweight. Dana Hunes teaches at the Fielding School of Public Health at the University of California, Los Angeles. She says fast foods, soft drink companies, and other businesses are having a major effect on the overweight and obesity epidemic in developing countries. In addition to diet, the way people live in developing countries is changing. As people move to cities and earn more money, they become less active, and they're putting on weight and following the pattern of the United States, noted Hunes. But there is another reason why people are gaining weight around the world, said psychotherapist Dina Solomon. People are moving away from their family, she said. They don't have the support system that is going to help them. Solomon noted that many people turn to food to help them deal with the pressures of everyday life. While popular diets may help with fast weight loss, staying thin is difficult. The studies show that plant-based diets are good long-term, said Hunes, who added that eating less meat helps with weight loss. Solomon asks overeaters to keep a record of everything they eat. She says that knowing what is eaten and controlling it becomes more powerful than the desire to eat. I'm Susan Shand.
This is What's Trending Today. The superhero movie Black Panther has already broken records at the box office. Now, it has broken a record on Twitter, too. The social media company says Black Panther is officially the most tweeted about movie ever. Twitter said this week the film has been tweeted about more than 35 million times. That pushes it ahead of the earlier record holder, Star Wars: The Force Awakens. The most recent Star Wars film, The Last Jedi, is third. Twitter said Black Panther had the most tweets in the United States, followed by Britain and Thailand. Over the weekend, the Marvel Studios film was the top-earning movie in North America for the fifth straight weekend. It has earned more than $607 million in the United States and almost $1.2 billion worldwide since its release in February. In the next week, observers expect Black Panther will pass The Avengers as the highest-earning superhero film in history. Twitter says the most commonly used hashtags about the film are hashtag Black Panther, hashtag Wakanda, and hashtag Wakanda Forever. Michelle Obama wrote one of the most shared Black Panther tweets. The former First Lady wrote, "Congrats to the entire Black Panther team. Because of you, young people will finally see superheroes that look like them on the big screen." Her post has been shared more than 140,000 times. Black Panther tells the story of an imaginary African nation called Wakanda. It is the home of the Black Panther himself, Prince T'Challa. In the film, Wakanda is a developed, highly technological country. It is both extremely modern and deeply traditional. It has never belonged to a foreign power. Black Panther is the 18th Marvel Comics film. It is based on comic book stories created by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby in 1966. Black Panther's director, Ryan Coogler, is Marvel Studios' youngest ever movie maker. And that's what's trending today.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In 1863, Union forces defeated Confederate forces in the bloodiest battle of the American Civil War, the Battle of Gettysburg. Soon after that, the Union won another important victory, seizing Vicksburg, Mississippi. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe continue our story of the Civil War with the Battle of Vicksburg.
In November 1863, President Lincoln traveled to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. He spoke at the opening of a military cemetery. He felt very tired by the time he got back to Washington. Doctors thought he had a cold. Later, they said he had a weak form of smallpox. The president remained in bed. Few visitors could see him. There was a danger the smallpox could spread. Lincoln got better after a few weeks. He began working on his yearly message to Congress. After 2.5 years of war, he had good news to report. Union armies had gained 2 important victories at about the same time.
One was the Battle of Gettysburg. Union forces, led by General George Meade, had defeated Confederate forces, led by General Robert E. Lee. They pushed Lee back into Virginia. It was the last Confederate invasion of the North. The day after the Battle of Gettysburg, Union forces defeated Confederate forces at Vicksburg, Mississippi. This victory gave them control of the Mississippi River, and it split the states of the Confederacy.
Union General Ulysses Grant had been trying to seize Vicksburg for several months. It was not easy. Vicksburg lay on the east side of the Mississippi River. It was built high above the water on a rocky cliff. As the river flowed past Vicksburg, it turned in sharply at the base of the cliff, and then continued on to the Gulf of Mexico. The Confederates had placed cannon all along the sharp turn in the river. Enemy boats sailing past made easy targets.
General Grant began the campaign for Vicksburg in late 1862. His army was west of the Mississippi River. He needed to get to the other side to attack the city. First, Grant planned to cross the river into northern Mississippi State. Then he would march south to Vicksburg. He crossed the river, but Confederate forces destroyed his transportation and supply lines. He withdrew. Early in 1863, he tried again.
This time, he planned to sail his men past Vicksburg. They would cross the river a little downstream, turn, and attack. Grant moved 40,000 men to a point 10 kilometers from Vicksburg. He told the men to put down their guns and take up digging tools. They would build a canal to carry them past the turn in the river, past the Confederate cannon.
For weeks, the Union soldiers worked on the canal. They dug through mud and wet clay. Many died of disease. After more than a month of digging, engineers decided that the canal would not work. Grant ordered the men to build another canal, then another. They did not work either. By this time, the Union soldiers had become experts at digging canals. One of them said, "As soon as the canals at Vicksburg are finished, we are going to cut a canal across the upper part of Florida. We will cut that state off from the Confederacy and give it to the alligators."
Finally, in April 1863, Grant gave up all ideas of getting past Vicksburg without a fight. He decided to march most of his men down the west side of the river to a steamboat landing 30 kilometers below Vicksburg. He would send his Navy boats past the city at night and hope for the best. It took 3 weeks for Grant's men to reach the steamboat landing. The roads were very rough. In many places, they were covered with water. Engineers had to cut trees and cover the muddy roads with logs so wagons would not sink. They had to build bridges over the many streams.
On the night of April 16th, the Union Navy made its run past Vicksburg. 8 gunboats and 3 empty troop boats floated down the dark river. Their engines were silent. The Confederates, however, had built fires along the river. They saw the Union boats and began to shoot. They hit most of the boats, but destroyed only one. The damaged boats reached safety below the city. On the last day of April, the Union troop boats began carrying soldiers to the east side of the river. About 23,000 men crossed. Right away, they faced a force of 8,000 Confederate soldiers. They drove the Confederates back.
Grant then ordered the rest of his army to cross to the east side of the river. Some of his officers protested. They said it would be impossible to get supplies to a large army east of the river. Grant was not worried about supplies. He said the men should bring only coffee, hard bread, and salt. Anything else could be taken from the farmers of Mississippi. Their homes, he said, were full of food.
Grant decided not to throw his men against the strong defenses around Vicksburg immediately. Instead, he marched them east toward Jackson, the state capital. Jackson was the supply base for the Confederate Army defending Vicksburg. Grant wanted to cut the supply lines between the two cities. He also wanted to prevent the soldiers in Jackson from joining the soldiers in Vicksburg. Grant captured Jackson easily. He left some troops to destroy enemy supplies. He took the remaining troops and turned back toward Vicksburg.
Grant attacked Vicksburg several times. Each time, his troops were thrown back. The city's defenses were too strong. Grant then decided to surround the city and wait until its food was gone. That, he thought, would make the Confederates surrender. Grant closed in with men and artillery. As one soldier wrote, "The circle of Union forces around the city was so tight that a cat could not have crept out without being discovered. Nothing could get out, nothing could get in." Weeks passed. The Union army shelled the city. The Confederate army answered from time to time. Food supplies dropped. There was little to eat except cornbread and the meat of mules. Some people caught rats and ate them.
Finally, the Confederate commander, General John Pemberton, decided the situation was hopeless. He sent word to Grant that he was ready to discuss surrender. The two commanders met under a white flag of truce. Grant demanded unconditional surrender. Pemberton rejected the demand. Pemberton's men were to be prisoners. That was a fact. But Pemberton wanted them released immediately on parole. He told Grant that his men would promise to stay out of the war if permitted to return to their homes. If not, he said, they would continue to fight.
Grant agreed to let the Confederate soldiers go home. He and Pemberton signed the surrender agreement on July 4th. The siege of Vicksburg had lasted 47 days. Never had a Union army won such a victory. Grant had taken 30,000 Confederate soldiers out of the war. He had captured 60,000 guns and 170 cannon. These were serious losses for the Confederacy. It already was low on manpower and weapons, but an even greater loss was the control of the Mississippi River. With Vicksburg in Union hands, the North could control the whole length of the river, and the Confederacy was split badly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.